Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Tuesday, May 26th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher C. Dub Wynn, deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Mr. Wynn.
Hello, CV, Chris Wagner.
Doesn't sound as good as C-Dub, but we'll let that roll.
It doesn't. It's true.
Also here, as always, is guest host Lauren Smart, arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
On today's program, author Jacob Silverman joins us to talk about his new book, Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection. Next, Will Evans, the founder of Dallas indie publisher Deep Vellum, is here to talk about what's next with his growing literary arts powerhouse. And last but not least, we all went to the Mac Saturday night to see Kitchen Dog Theater's new play, The Firestorm. We'll talk to the play's director, Tina Parker, who will also tell us about the group's big upcoming move. Let's get this started.
Hello, Twitter bird. Tweet a little tweet on Twitter. Any little thing will do.
Tweet's a winner. You can do it too.
Yes.
Jacob Silverman is a Brooklyn-based writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The New Republic. He also serves on the board of Dallas's Deep Vellum Publishing. In 2012, he was a three-time Jeopardy champion. So if you want to borrow some money, he's a good guy to call. Silverman's new book is Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of a Constant Connection. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we should start with Jeopardy because I'm really curious. How do you get on the show? And then can you give us some tricks for winning?
I did the online test, which I think they offer once or twice a year. And then eventually I got called to do an in-person tryout. And then eventually after that, I got called to be on the show. But the whole thing actually takes a little while, so if you want to get on the show, I'd say start now.
That's a good tip. I think I'm gonna follow your advice. Going home right now to take the test.
Let's talk about your book, Jacob. You compare social media to social surveillance. Why? And is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, it's not entirely good or bad, I'd say. One thing I try to emphasize in the book is I think surveillance is not just something that happens to us or. In my subtitle of my book, I say the price of constant connection. The price of constant connection is partly surveillance of having everything you do being watched and monitored and producing personal data about yourself. But surveillance is also something we do socially and sort of a culture we live in now. So we watch one another. We keep up with each other's updates. We set up profiles for ourselves that people can then access or monitor. We post location information about where we are or photos and things like that. So one thing I definitely try to talk about and make clear is that we can't just say that surveillance is bad and that we've kind of wandered into this world of total surveillance. It's actually a real part of our lives now, and even how we communicate with each other and how we identify ourselves as we set ourselves up to be surveilled. So I think we really need this larger picture of what surveillance is.
You know, funny, to that point, a couple of items I liked from your book talking about that is one, you said, quote, social surveillance fulfills our hunger to see and be seen. It offers a finishing school for the self, which I thought was funny. And then more specifically to Americans, Americans tend to see themselves as unrecognized famous people. And so we submit to social surveillance because it helps us to feel famous. So is it just our egos at play, Jacob?
Well, I think in some ways ego plays a big part of it. Certainly this idea of ego being part of tied to your identity. I've been thinking a lot, and I talk in the book about this too, this idea of visibility and what does that mean as sort of social creatures, as people who now increasingly need to be seen to feel like people know who we are, that it's really part of our identity now is to have these online personas that are supposed to reflect who we are and kind of in the day-to-day world. I think that in some ways this can cause insecurity or anxiety, and that's certainly tied to this idea of ego. But it's also just become something very natural for people now that we want to be seen by our friends. We want our friends and colleagues or people we'd like to be our friends, perhaps, to know what's going on with us. So this way of kind of serving ourselves up for public consumption, while it can be fraught in a lot of ways, I think has also become a very accepted part of how we present ourselves.
Well, and they even taught that in grad school. I went to grad school for journalism, graduated 3 years ago, and we would spend days talking about developing your online presence, your identity, your personal brand, and how you could reflect that in your social media channels, which as someone who grew up in the internet was absurd to me. It's something that you kind of know how to do these days.
And I also think it's interesting that we sort of started with, hey, you need to have an online presence. If you're a journalist, you should have a website that has contact information for yourself. And now it's sort of grown. I think it's expanded not just beyond journalists who are expected to have a website or be available online, but all kinds of professions are now expected to maintain online presences. And in some ways, we've moved beyond from mere presence to activity. It's not enough to just have your profiles on the right sites, whether you're a journalist or a restaurant owner who has a Yelp profile and all those sorts of things. You actually have to be active with them. And I think that reflects a shift in attitude and this notion of being public figures that I've been talking about. But also, it reflects how this kind of online activity has become a new form of work for a lot of people.
And Jacob, one quick follow-up question to that. How do you propose balancing the personal and the professional? How do you draw the line between here's something I'm doing officially for my job and here's something I made for dinner?
I think it can be difficult, especially because we use a lot of the same channels or platforms for personal identity construction, to sound a little academic about it, or for more professional uses. So sometimes you might also have people from your professional world and your personal life on the same network. You're Facebook friends with all of them, or they follow you on Instagram or the like. I think it can be really difficult, and this is one of the issues I'm trying to tackle, which is that it can produce a lot of anxiety for people, this sense of being on display or having to keep up not only with what's new and what's happening, but also with posting and things like that and seeming like you're a good social media user. I think for a lot of people, it just comes down to what are you comfortable with your own self and what, how do you want to live your life and how much of a public face you want to have. But there are also all these implicit pressures, both from one's professional network or from your friends, and it can also be practically mandated depending on what your job is. So for some people, it may be something that they need to tackle by talking to their bosses or supervisors and saying, you know, I'm more of a private person. I don't really want to be posting about my job or promoting work on social media all day.
Well, and it also seems like there's an issue of ownership, and like I think you address it in the book, some is just who actually owns the content, and a lot of times the content that is our private lives. Like last year, Richard Prince, the artist, famously screenshotted Instagram photos and turned them into an art exhibit, and many of them sold for tens of thousands of dollars. And I guess I'm curious, you know, do you think we're giving too much of our own lives away, or are we losing privacy at a cost?
Oh, I think so. And I like that Richard Prince exhibit. I think it's a great provocation. I think people have often taken it for granted, or there's this sort of cynical attitude, well, you shouldn't expect privacy online, or a lot of these services are free, so the cost of using them is either giving up privacy or giving up ownership of your personal data, or even as you indicated, the raw materials of your life, the photos of you and your family can be turned into an ad on Google Plus or Facebook if one of them decides to.
I want to jump into kind of along those lines. Journalists are also capitalizing on that content. Tell me about the term churnalism, which I loved. Churnalism.
Oh, sure.
It sounds very sinister, and we're probably participating in it. But what is it?
Well, I think it's a term, I'm not sure when its origins are exactly, but I believe it sort of derives from last 10 or 20 years and kind of the flood of information that journalists are faced with now and the pressures a lot of journalists, and I include myself in this category, have to simply produce, to produce content in the way that a factory worker would produce cars or anything else. In a lot of ways, we're just workers kind of churning out material for public consumption. And a lot of journalists now find that they have to be really active in what I call the churn. So this is all this information that's coming from companies and in the form of press releases or announcements or strategic leaks. And what you see across the journalism industry, especially because we're all kind of watching one another and we all have access to the same material online, is that you see a lot of the same issues just being rehashed and recovered over and over again because everyone has to cover it in some way. So I think one of the problems that journalism faces now is that everyone feels the pressure to, and oftentimes it's a financial pressure, to just have the most basic kind of coverage or the most basic angle for some news event. And I think this is a real problem in some ways. We say that consumers have the right, you know, to browse anywhere, to choose who they're getting their information from and to judge for themselves. This is supposed to be a much more democratic space. But a lot of people are just logging on, clicking what's in their Facebook feed, and it might be total junk, and they're not going to click through to see who originally reported the story or who had the best version of the story.
So if I'm not going to unplug completely, what would be a solution to what I think is the social media problem or problems?
Well, I think there you can look at it a couple different ways. One is that we definitely do suffer on the security side in terms of privacy and the collection of personal data. So while you can never be 100% secure, and it can really require becoming a security expert to manage your online profile and reputation in any meaningful way, I do recommend to people that they look into things like VPNs or ad blockers to block ad trackers and things like that, or even things like the Tor browser. It's just good to get people thinking about their own security and privacy. But more on this sort of personal, social, and cultural side that we're talking about, I also think people should just think critically about these companies. I mean, these are the new powers in our world, these big tech companies, and they really are monopolizing or commoditizing our basic friendships and communications for their own tremendous profit. So if you're not comfortable with that, I think there's nothing to lose from quitting Facebook or anything like that. There is life after Facebook. So I'm hoping that people will start thinking more critically about those companies and also the role that their own basic everyday communications play in kind of driving this kind of power dynamic.
Jacob Silverman's book, Terms of Service, is available at your local bookseller and online at Amazon.com, of course. Jacob, thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to start tweeting about you right now.
All right, that's perfectly fine. Thank you.
Facebook, I'm hooked on Facebook. I used to meet girls hanging out at the mall, but now I just wait for them to write on my wall. Take a look, you're hooked on Facebook.
Will Evans is the founder of Deep Vellum, a nonprofit publisher of translated world literature based in Dallas's Deep Ellum neighborhood. He also holds a master's degree in Russian culture from Duke University. Deep Vellum is planning an ambitious expansion this year, which helped land it on FD Magazine's annual Hot List, which debuts in the June issue this Sunday. Will, welcome to Mixed Media.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for that strategic leak of that FD information. That's amazing. Thank you, guys. Wow.
That's what we call a tease in this business.
Yeah, exactly. I was invited on before I knew that, so that's really amazing. I'm honored. Thank you. Dallas has been wonderful to Deep Vellum.
And then we threw in a little Dr. Zhivago music even just to kind of ease you in. So, Will, forget Tolstoy. I've learned from having coffee with you a while back that your obsession with Russian literature began in the ninth grade. And that's when you discovered the little-known Maxim Gorky novel, The Life of a Useless Man. So why was that a game changer for you? And did it impact your ability to get a date?
That's a great question, Chris. Well, I'm married now happily, so my wife is a big nerd too, thankfully. So, you know, getting a date is not my biggest problem anymore. But yeah, you go back to that book. In ninth grade, I knew nothing of the world. I'd never left, you know, the Southeast. I'm from North Carolina. And we were told in this ninth grade class, which was quote-unquote world literature, and like 90% of what we read in that class was British literature. Mm-hmm. And so it was still in English originally, but for one book report, we were forced to read a work in translation, and like all of my classmates, I remember yelling, like, well, how can we read it if it wasn't written in English originally? And our teacher said, well, you know, it's translated by someone. So here's a list of all the books in the library that are translated from another language. Go read one. And so I picked the one that I thought had the coolest name. I had no interest in Russia before that, but I read this book, which is about the 1905 Russian Revolution, which took place right around the time of the Russo-Japanese War. And I did like history. I'd always been fascinated with history. And I read this book, and it's a very realist, historical piece of fiction told from the perspective of the workers. Gorky went on later after writing this to become Lenin's favorite writer. And then later he invented socialist realism, which became the state art form in the Soviet Union under Stalin. And so, you know, I read this book by Gorky. And Gorky, you know, when I tell my Russian professors in university, like, how'd you get into this? I read a Gorky novel, and he's like, oh my God. So, but it was kind of cool because I now publish a Russian author named Mikhail Shishkin, and he grew up during the Soviet Union, and obviously he grew up reading Gorky. He was mandated in school, and he's like, you know, when I told him, he asked me, he's like, how'd you get into this? I said, well, Gorky. And he goes, that's really amazing. You're the only person I've ever met who got into Russian literature from Gorky. I was like, yeah. He goes, he was a great writer. His politics, let's not go there, but his writing is truly remarkable. And so Gorky opened the door to Russian literature to me through my interest in history.
And for us who are in the studio with you, we can see that you have tattoos up and down your left arm. Exactly how many masters of Russian literature are in those tattoos?
Those massive biceps.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Yeah. No, I didn't think you could notice, but I am wearing my tightest shirt today.
Is that Ivan Drago on your right bicep?
No, I don't have any fighters on my arm. I do have masters of Russian literature tattooed on my arm. So I have Pushkin and Gogol, who are two of the classics, and then Mayakovsky. And so those are the three, and then I have a lot of Russian art.
And they look very badass. Like, if you told me you were going to show me literary figures on your arm, I'd be like, oh. But they look cool.
Look, man, if there was like one, you know, someone asked me once, like, what is success going to be for Deep Vellum? And what I should say is to make people realize that literature is badass. Like, yeah. It is not messing around. Like, literature rules.
Literature
it can change
can
your life.
You.
Literature can hurt you. Literature can hurt other people. Like, literature can topple regimes, and literature can, like, make you want to kill yourself. Like, it's a very powerful art form. And so, like, thank you for noticing my tattoos and letting me say that. Literature is badass. Like, read good books. The worse books you read, the lamer your life is.
Will, tell us a little bit about what you think distinguishes a good translation, a quality translation, from a subpar translation.
That's a great question. I mean, it's something that really drives what I do on a daily basis at Deep Vellum. It's like the question that keeps me up at night. So for me, I think every editor in translation, editor or publisher, whatever, the person who kind of shepherds the translation. There are many people along the way between translators and authors, and then between translators and readers. And so a lot of times I have a translator who got criticized for naming his book The Art of Flight, which we published in March, because the title in Spanish had a double entendre in the title, and it could also have been translated as The Art of the Fugue, like the Bach title. But he was going for something else, and so he had to make a choice in English. And so the fact is, as an editor, I made that choice. He goes, here are the two options, and I was like, it's this one. And the reader doesn't know that.
The power.
And so then the review comes in and they're like, oh, the translator chose, you know, the terrible title. And it was like, well, you know, poor guy. But I think that for me, the most important thing about a good translation is that it really does capture what the original is going for.
I know at The Observer we've reviewed quite a few of your books now. And
thank you.
Yeah. And we've noticed, those of us who've read them and talked about them, that many of your selections play a lot with language. And kind of explore how language can be used to tell a story, but really are just playing with and talking about language. How do you pick the books that you're choosing to publish?
God, great question. So what's funny is, your latest review of the Shishkin book talks about language being at the heart of it. There was another review that came out a couple weeks ago that said that politics is at the heart of it. And so it's kind of funny because they're both right. And when I did pick these first books, I did not pick them necessarily because they have anything in common. In fact, I tried to pick books that were as absolutely different from one another as I could. And the only thing that really unites them is that they were translated from another language. The styles, the genres, the stories are all quite different. But if you were reading high literature, there are only so many themes that people talk about in high literature.
Sure.
Language is absolutely one of them. Politics is absolutely one of them. Memory is another one. Death is one. Love. These themes do weave their way in. And so I guess at the beginning, I had very grand ambitions for Deep Vellum when I moved to Dallas. And one of the ways to really, become established or respected in world publishing is to publish like great authors. And to publish a certain type of great author that legitimizes what I'm doing. Because in America, I have to fight to be heard. Everyone's in New York. And so when I'm down here in Dallas, like, it's amazing that the Dallas Observer and the Dallas Morning News have reviewed Deep Vellum books. That has shocked people in New York. They're like, our books aren't being reviewed there. And it's like, well, it's part of my mission to make people in Dallas like want to listen. So A, thanks for inviting me on. B, thanks for reviewing them. Like, can't do it without you guys, obviously. But it also goes to show that like the books are quite great and that they are in dialogue with each other. And then one analogy I heard about publishers from a European friend who is a publisher is that like, you know, the most important thing about a publisher is their backlist, who they have published. You know, the stuff that's hot right now, whatever. Like, let's talk about what the backlist is. And he goes, it's like your authors are all at a dinner party. How can you get them to talk to each other? And then how can you get a reader to come and sit at that dinner party?
What a great dinner party you're hosting exactly. Right now.
And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm like trying to create the coolest dinner party with these authors who are like a range of ages and generations. I started with living writers so that I could try and bring as many of them to Dallas as possible to be like, look, there's a real thing we're building here, and it's about it's as much about you as it is about me. I'm not a vanity publisher. I'm doing this because I want to read these books in English too, but I'm a reader. And so I'm a reader. You know, Joe on the street is a reader. I hope he's a reader. it's just about building something amazing. So thank you for reading the bigger picture of what I'm doing, because that's like fun. And I'm actually trying to build like the third list of books I'm doing right now. I'm like, how are they talking to each other? And I have choices about where to slot things in. And I do want them to speak to each other. And I don't know exactly what that conversation is right now. That's spring 2016 I'm planning right now.
So say Joe on the street comes up to you and says, Will, I want to read the Russian Masters. I really want to familiarize myself with these great books.
What a day that will
Where
be.
Do yeah. I
He saw your tattoos what, and got inspired.
What's the one book I should start with? What's the essential building block?
If I'm looking at Chris Wagner, if I'm looking at Chris Wagner as opposed to any average Joe, I do this like based on, you know, I'm judging people based on their looks, their appearance, how this question is phrased.
How Dallas.
Yeah, which is what we all do. But, right. You know, the fact of the matter is the Russians, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, are light years apart in terms of style, content, humor, pathos, sex, religion, all that fun stuff. I think that some of the best recommendations you can give, I always recommend The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. Mm-hmm. It's a mid-Soviet period, wonderful novel, but no one will ever call it a Soviet novel. But it definitely is. I mean, it's a great Russian novel. It's a great Soviet novel that satirizes the Soviet system in one of its three stories. And then the other ones are a bit grander. One is the story of Jesus and Pontius Pilate. And then the other story is The Master and Margarita, his lover. And he's writing a book that is the book you are reading, it's the book about Jesus and Pontius. And so that book is amazing because, A, it's funny. No one ever thinks of Russian literature being funny. B, it's truly amazing. Like, you could underline every sentence in there and be like, oh my God, I'm learning about everything. But then the second recommendation I would make is to read Gogol's short stories, because not every Russian book has to be huge. Read his Petersburg stories in particular, The Nose, The Overcoat, Nevsky Prospect. He's funny. He's tragic. He's all the things we love about Russian literature. And they're short. You don't have to read Anna Karenina every time you read a Russian book. And The Master Margarita, must be said, is around 300, 400 pages. So it's a mid-sized Russian book.
I read Notes from Underground because it was short. I'm like, I can knock that one out.
Yeah, one of the problems with short books is sometimes they are harder to read than the big ones. And Notes from Underground is one of the most difficult books I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, it's wrenching.
Yeah.
Tell us about what is going on with Deep Vellum this year. You have some big and very ambitious expansion plans.
Where to start, Chris? I've had big and ambitious expansion plans since I started the publisher. You know, I started being a publishing house that's publishing 10 books a year, which is insane. I don't have any backing capital. So anyone out there who's listening and has backing capital and wants to sponsor a publisher, I am a 501c3 nonprofit now. That's been the
officially,
biggest.
Yeah.
Officially. So the grand ambition this year is to move out of the co-working space in Deep Vellum, where I've been working, which I love and I will miss every day, the Common Desk. They've been wonderful to Deep Vellum.
Good coffee there.
Great coffee. Great coffee. Great people. I didn't know a single person when I moved to Dallas. And so working at the Common Desk introduced me to so many people of different, you know, fields. And, it helped me fall in love with this city. You know, I'm down there on the street level in the city. And that's a really nice feeling to be a part of this community and this culture. And I targeted Deep Ellum when I moved here because of, you know, there's so much cultural history in that neighborhood. And so the plan is to move out to get some office space, trying to get, you know, 1,000 square feet, which isn't huge, but it's quite big, to store the books, set up mailings, to start bringing in interns, to start teaching them about publishing. I'm going to try and hire some more full-time staff. And, yeah, fundraising and building community and doing more events and just in general making more awesome stuff happen.
I like that you've described in the past that talking about bookstores specifically, that bookstores are not rent generating, they are community generating. I think that's so true. I couldn't agree more. What do you think of the current state of Dallas bookshops and what do we need more of?
I think Lauren should answer this question. just kidding. I think that the state of Dallas bookshops is both promising because it can't get any lower than where it was a year ago. And it's also it's always a bit disheartening, and I won't lie.
Sure.
You know, Dallas, we always look to the outside to compare ourselves, which is really the wrong thing to do. But if you look around, man, like this is a city of 1.5 million people, and we have one independent bookstore where you can buy new books. And that bookstore is as big as the room that we are sitting in, and that is a shame. We have 1.5 million people. They're not touching.
I'm talking about Wild Detectives.
I'm talking about the Wild Detectives who have single-handedly changed the literary community here because they are a place where anyone who likes books can go see and be seen. The fact of the matter is they're the only bookstore in town that sells my books. And that is a problem that, like, Barnes & Noble doesn't fit a community niche. Actually, I think you can get my books at Barnes & Noble. I shouldn't give them a hard time. But, like, Barnes & Noble fills a specific niche, a very commercial niche. And Half Price Books is a wonderful used bookstore. However, they don't stock my books, you know, unless you have returned the books, which I'm totally cool with. You know, it's part of the ecosystem. But a used bookstore does not solely make a literary community. It's a part, a vital part. And so when I look around, it's like, well, what do we need? We need a bookstore like Brazos Books in Houston.
Yeah.
We need a bookstore like Book People in Austin. We need a bookstore like Malvern Books in Austin.
I think what gets lost in the conversation, people say, oh, we're not New York, or we're not. I mean, Denver has a great new bookstore. Charlotte,
Minneapolis
has a great new bookstore.
Portland.
Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, cities that are much smaller than Dallas have great new bookstores. Mm-hmm. So it's not about trying to be one of the coastal empire cities.
Absolutely. And I think it's great. Like, I have, since coming to Dallas, I've been saying Dallas should look to Minneapolis for its inspiration on how to develop it internally, its arts community, because outside of New York, Minneapolis is up there with Chicago and LA in terms of its cultural riches. Per capita, I think it has, you know, the most theaters outside of New York. It's by far the most literary city in the country outside of New York. They have the most bookstores, diversity of publishing houses, literary nonprofits. There are, you know, nonprofit developers there that give space to literary nonprofits or at way below market rate. We have nothing like that in Dallas. Like, Deep Ellum is looking for office space. Where am I going to go? Unless someone is feeling tremendously generous and wants to give me space, the fact is I can't afford market rates in this city. We are tapped out of office space unless I want to go to South Dallas, down in Duncanville, essentially. And that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to build community in the urban core. Fact of the matter is urban core doesn't really care if I'm there or not.
Right.
And that's a problem.
What's the next book from Deep Ellum coming down the pike?
Next book comes out in June. It's called The Mountain and the Wall. It's a Russian novel, actually, by a woman named Alisa Ganeva. It's the first true debut novel I've published. This book came out when she was like 26 in Russia. And it's a really remarkable book. She's from the Republic of Dagestan, which is in the south of Russia in the Caucasus Mountains next to Chechnya. This will be the first novel ever from that region. We're also about to announce our fall list of books. And so those start in September and go through March. So it's six titles from Democratic Republic of Congo. Got books from Indonesia, Argentina, Chile, Iceland, and the Netherlands. So, I mean, it's like four continents and authors that you've like never read before, but there are books that are absolutely amazing.
I had one quick side question. We had Jacob Silverman on earlier. He's on your board, and I wondered how that came about. How do you guys know each other? And by the way, we booked him before I realized that he served on the board, so that was an interesting synchronicity.
Jacob has been one of my oldest friends since university. So my sophomore year, I took Russian 201, and this freshman showed up with two other guys he went to high school with in LA, where he's from, and they had all taken Russian in high school, and so we ended up in the same class. And then Jacob and I ended up studying abroad in Russia together in 2004, and we became close. He liked, you know, we both like indie music, indie hardcore punk stuff. But Jacob was in New York. He had just moved there from LA. He'd been published and writing book reviews and doing creative writing fellowships. He just knew a little bit more about the ecosystem of how publishing works. And so I called him for advice a lot. And he gave me a lot of advice and introduced me to people. And so when the time came to found Deep Vellum, to be a nonprofit, you have to have three people on your board from day one. I didn't know three people in Dallas. And so I had to ask three friends that I asked for advice on publishing stuff. And so it was Jacob was one of those three guys. I said, Jacob, would you mind being on my board here at the beginning? You know, like I'm trying to build this thing and you've been so helpful. And he said, I would be honored. And so then the really cool thing is this book comes out this year. And on the flap, the back flap with his picture, it's his bio. And then at the bottom, it says he serves on the board of Deep Vellum, a publisher of international literature. And that was a real big honor that like we were able to connect the dots like that. It's really cool.
It's cool.
You can keep up with Will Evans at deepvellum.org and read more about his work in the June issue of FD Magazine. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's not right, and it feels so black and white. Tell me, Mikey, is it me? It's just society filled with propaganda.
Tina Parker is Kitchen Dog Theater's co-artistic director. She has been with the Maverick Theater Group since 1993. She is an SMU grad and working actress who played the recurring role of the Secretary Francesca on the hit AMC series Breaking Bad. Right now, Parker is directing the national rolling world premiere of a play called The Firestorm, written by Meredith Friedman. The Firestorm is about a white politician whose marriage to a black woman is threatened by the public unearthing of a racist prank. The play is part of Kitchen Dog Theater's final season at the McKinney Avenue Contemporary in Dallas. Very sad, very sad. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that I really liked about this play and the production is that it's about race, but it's also about these very precise individual characters who are really well delineated throughout. So I'm wondering how you work that balance of concept and story as you're putting this together.
Well, it all came from talking to Meredith, because her intention with the play was to really investigate the relationship, like to investigate the relationship of these characters. It wasn't so much about race to start with. It was about how much you're willing to reveal of yourself, and are you willing to deal with it once it's out in the open? And then she kind of weaved in the political context, because what's great is you have the whole wag the dog concept in politics. You create an image that may or may not be who you really are. So that just adds another layer of complication. I think when we were working in the rehearsal room, what was important to me was focusing in on just the two of them and what that relationship was and what were the landmines that they hide from each other. And if you don't root for that marriage, the play just turns into a play of jerks. So that's where we started, was just from the core that these people loved each other and they had great chemistry, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's where it started from.
That's something that was clear to me too in the opening of the play. I loved the chemistry between Patrick, the character Patrick, played by Cameron Cobb, and Gabby, played by Kenesha Thompson. Just that flirtatious banter, just their energy, the body language as they kind of danced and played. They're in the kitchen in that opening scene, kind of talking to each other. You really get on their side. You believe the relationship, and you're rooting for them. So when things take a turn, you're in it.
And I was struck by what decent people they are. I mean,
they're
people you feel like you know. And I feel like usually when people want to address really intense topics, especially racism today, you end up with these characters that are doing things that you would never do in your lifetime. And I felt like even what we learn he had done as a young person, it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But how many, when I went to SMU, I can't tell you how many people, frat boys I know who would have done something similar.
Right. Well, and I think that's why it needs to be set up that way, because you can look back in your own history and say, oh, I said X, Y, and Z to so-and-so, not knowing, wow, that could be racist if someone else heard it. And so I think it's important to set it up like these are just regular Joes, not like extreme. It's not the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
It's the guy you know next door. It's the woman that you work with. And that's why I think it creates the conversation. It's not an easy conversation, but I think that's why it's effective, I think.
The first thing I thought about was the recent story with the guys on the bus in Oklahoma.
Oh, man.
A couple
Me too.
Of whom turned out to be from Dallas. Shining moment for us.
Yeah,
But then, you think about what these people may be like years down the line, if they're going to regret their thoughts or their actions or whatnot, right. And that they are in fact human beings.
And it comes back to, you know, this whole conversation that you guys have been having about social media. It's like, if you look back in your own past, some of us old timers here, you know, before social media, like even, you know, things you might have, oh, I'm at a party and I'm wearing a sombrero or whatever. It's like,
right.
Well, no, I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah.
That, I mean, thank God.
None of that's captured on a video or whatever. And not that I'm not excusing those guys, but nowadays, anything you do is possible to be, you know, it's from 2008. Here is a conversation that Lauren Smart had in The Observer, and where she called them "you people" or something, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I think you've just got to
Lauren.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. I think it's a whole different ballgame in this day and age where stuff can, you know, it's kind of pointing out what's been going on all along, I think.
Yeah.
There's kind of a funny moment, too, where the character of Leslie, played by Janelle Kastner, who, by the way, is Lauren Smart's doppelganger.
No, I don't know if that's true. She's much taller and thinner and celebrity. She looks like a celebrity. She's gorgeous. Janelle is gorgeous.
She's very funny, but she's a handler working with Patrick, and there's a kind of a funny moment where she's trying to gently talk with Gabby, who is a woman of color and a trust attorney. And she's trying to kind of help groom her to be the politician's wife. And she's trying to, you know, talk with her in an offensive way about her hair, maybe smoothing her hair or dressing in more vibrant colors or adding a scarf,
right.
You know, talking about religion. You know, hey, how do you feel about kids? How do you feel about religion?
It's all the wag
it's
the
so dog.
It's the wag the dog of politics. It's unfortunate. I mean, what's interesting, and when Meredith was doing her research, going back to before Barack ran for president, if you go back to looking at interviews with Michelle, her styling, mm-hmm. the way she was handled, even like if you just keep going through the years, like how it's changed and how it's morphed. Same thing, look at Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
First year she ran for president, totally different packaging. Didn't work. New packaging this year. So it's
right,
all about
right.
the package and... Unfortunately.
I
want everybody to, you know, just like us, I go to the garbage can and it's like I roll up my sleeves and I'm posing by a
Target
cow.
Too.
Maybe I never have farmed in my life, but it looks, the image is good and that's all I see. Because sadly, unfortunately for the book person, but they don't, a lot of people don't read.
Right.
I know it's offensive. So you just got to have a
lost
really.
Will.
I know. I just lost Will. He started crying.
He's turning
just,
purple.
But it's that.
His tattoos are weeping.
I know. It's all about the image, unfortunately, in a soundbite.
The optics.
Yeah. And I was struck by the sexism of that, too. I mean, like, I remember I talked to Meredith before the play came out, and she was saying, well, you know, I was really scared when I started writing this because is this my story to tell? How do I tell it? And she mm-hmm. said that one of the people she'd interviewed, who was a political advisor, said, no, you're a woman. So yeah,
right.
this is, you have experienced a lot of what she's experienced, just maybe not the racism.
Right.
There's a lot to it.
There's a lot to it. And what's crazy is the woman who's playing Gabby, actually the journey that Gabby takes throughout the play, she's experienced that because she's been caught in the two worlds of like, you're not black enough from the black community, and you're not, and you got everything you got because you're black from the white community. So she's trapped in this nether zone, just like Gabby has been. So she brought a lot of personal experience and really informed a lot of, as we were doing rewrites and stuff at the table, some choices that Meredith was, you know, investigating. So
we want to talk some more Kitchen Dog. We want to talk about the New Works Festival and the move. But first, we want to talk a little bit about Breaking Bad. How you landed that gig.
All this was a ruse to get you in to talk about that.
Will you be on Better Call Saul?
Hey, man, I want to be on Better Call Saul. Let's just put that out there. He's just got to go bad. He's just,
right.
so, yeah, he's still good. So until he, you know, turns, although there was some hope at the end. Because it looks like he may be driving down the path to Salt a little quicker. So hopefully he'll go to that DMV and find me that he says he found me at. No, I was just put on tape by my agent. And, you know, and I went when I actually, when I went in, when I read for it originally, I was like, oh, this is going to be a blonde, blue-eyed, big boob, Skeletor wearing business outfits. So I was like, well, I'm not any of those things. I have boobs, big ones, but, you know, I'm not a Skeletor and I'm not blonde. So I was like, well, what do I have that brings something to the table that's uniquely me? So I actually dressed kind of rockabilly, which is strange. Mm-hmm. And walked in and all the girls were like, what in the hell? Because there's a bunch of blonde, big boobed ladies there. And just was super sassy. And that was the tape. And I was like, well, I'm going to risk big. Who cares? Didn't hear anything. And actually on the podcast, I found out they have a podcast after, you know, shows or whatever. And after my big scene that I've got at the end of four, they interview Vince and they say, well, how did you find Tina or whatever? And he's like, yeah, there were a lot of, they kept showing me all these tapes. I didn't want any of these women because they, you know, I wanted them to have, be attracted to something non-traditional because I just think Saul is a wacky dude. And the casting director was like, well, there's this girl. I think she's really good. She's not probably right, but do you want to look at it? And he said, this is exactly what I want. And literally, I got called 3 hours before I had to get on a plane and go. Luckily, I wasn't doing a show or anything. 3 hours and had to fly to Albuquerque and shoot the first episode with Bob. Wow. So it was totally crazy. But one of the best, hands down, I think the best gig of my life. I mean, I've worked a lot of different shows, but just the whole, it was land of enchantment for sure on that project, because everybody from the stars down to the PA, so PA is so nice, so invested in the project, you know, people getting excited about your upcoming scene that you don't even know about. Like, I had so many people like, oh my God, your lines next episode are so amazing. And I'm like, do I have lines? That's exciting. You know, I didn't know I was coming back. That's great. So I hope to be on the new show just because they're friends and it's, and you know, it's an amazing team of people.
Vince Gilligan, if you're listening,
I know,
to Vince, Mixed Media, Tina Parker is available.
Yeah, and Peter Gould, who created those characters, they're co-showrunners. So, shout out to Peter.
So the New Works Festival, this, the Firestorm is the main stage.
It's the main stage production. It's the fully produced show of the New Works Festival. This is our 17th. My goodness.
Wow.
17th New Works Festival. Yeah, we read a whole lot of plays. I think we read about 400 this year.
Oh, my God.
From all over the world. And we've narrowed it down to 6 stage readings, which will start this weekend. We have 2 on Saturday, one at 1 o'clock, one at 4 o'clock. And then we also have Pupfest, which is our youth playwriting component that we co-produce with junior players featuring high school writers. This weekend is kind of fun because we have... Sam and Dee Dee, or My Dinner with Andre the Giant, which is actually a play. Samuel Beckett and Andre the Giant actually knew each other. He drove him to school, and the playwright now has made up this play of 3 scenes based on that incident. And then Tara Obenier, which is by Chicago, about a Chicago woman who, strangely enough, is about the internet and about how somebody saw a picture of her laughing at a woman falling on the street, and it blew up, and everybody's out to get her. And she's like, no, I was laughing at my friend, not at the old woman falling down. So it's all about the internet and how trolls are mean, basically.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun.
And so, for people who don't know, the stage readings that you guys do are really fun. There's usually, going to a theater party.
Yeah, it's not boring. I think they're a whole lot of fun. And I make Bloody Marys. I'm known for my Bloody Marys.
They're delicious.
And I have a gourmet popcorn bar and snacks, so you can... have a nice
snack. I'm in.
Yeah, and there's discussions after. So we record all these. Some of the playwrights aren't able to come in from wherever they're at. So we record them all and send them to them. So you actually can have impact on how these plays develop, because a lot of these plays are in the first stages of development. So the audience feedback is vital to how the play grows.
You had me at snacks.
Yeah. The snacks are really good, y'all.
A gourmet popcorn bar. Yeah.
I'm telling you. Delicious.
Could I jump in with a comment about that? So,
boy.
Would you like to know my recipe?
Ladies and gentlemen, Will Evans.
Well, of course, I get into the literary stuff about drama, but like one of the things about Deep Vellum is being a nonprofit is about publishing underpublished and underrepresented communities, and one of those is drama, translated dramas. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great stuff out there that's never translated into English, and all of my authors are also dramatists and poets, and they write nonfiction.
Oh, wow.
And only in America do we really segmentize genre.
That's true.
So I have authors, including Jón Gnarr, the former mayor of Reykjavik, who has written several plays that have won awards and things. And one cool thing is he was in Houston over the past semester at Rice, and they did a staged reading of one of his plays in English. So it was the first time it had ever been done in English. And the nice thing about that is it got me really thinking, like, I do love theater, and I love reading theater as literature. And so one of the goals I have for the future is to start publishing translated drama only if we can get the English language premiere in Dallas in the theaters that we have here.
Are you networking on our show?
I literally, I just want everyone out there listening.
Networking.
No, listen to this. So start doing like staged readings of these things so that like there's a reason.
We would totally be down with that.
Yes. Thank you, Chris Wagner.
Can you guys exchange business cards?
We'll exchange business cards.
Go out for coffee.
Actually, what we could do, let's talk after, because we could actually designate a spot of the New Works, because we do have a designated slot in the New Works. We're paired with the University of Texas MFA playwriting program, which is one of the premier playwriting programs in the country. And this is the third year of that partnership. And the last weekend of our festival will feature a writer that's about to graduate from that program. So we do have, we can talk because maybe we can designate a translations box. We've had translations before.
So Kitchen Dog is moving.
Yes,
by
we
the
are.
Way. Moving to the Green Zone. Can you tell us about that?
This breaks my heart,
I know.
By the way.
It seems strange.
Hey, man, you're not having to pack 20 years of crap.
True
breaks
that.
My heart and breaks my back.
Right.
But it is what it is, you know? I think the owner of our building has had offers on that building since we've been there, frankly.
Right. It's a great space.
Well, and now the market over there is the property values have just skyrocketed along with the taxes.
Yeah, I bet.
And so, you know, she got an offer she couldn't refuse, basically. And I totally understand that. So the building's being repurposed. We had a year to kind of know that this was a strong possibility. So our temporary home will be, after this season, our temporary home will be at the Green Zone over in the Design District. We're doing all of that season, which happens to be our 25th anniversary season, y'all.
Mm.
We are old and tired and mighty. But the whole
and bloody
season,
married.
Yeah, I'm telling you. We're going to be drinking a lot of those. But it will be over at the Green Zone, and the whole season will be there. And it's a full season. The 25th season is 5 main stages, 6 stage readings, Pub Fest. So we're not shying back, for sure. And there'll be other special events that we'll announce as we go on through the year. And it will be a kind of a company-centric season. That's how we're planning it. So really focusing on plays, that's what you'll notice if you're looking at the list of plays. They're a lot smaller cast. Mm-hmm. The goal is to have almost 100% cast of company members as well as company designers. So it's kind of getting back to the tenets of Kitchen Dog, which is actor-driven stories, you know, produced by actors in a small space, in your face, you can't look at your phone, theater that you have to deal with and ask questions about. So that's where we'll be temporarily. And then we're in lease negotiations for a more permanent home. And until that's all ironed out, I mean, I don't know where we're going to go just yet. Looks like there's a strong possibility of maybe a place, but until that's finalized, we're not going to announce it. It's just a lot of dollars. So, you know, we're in the
right.
beginning stages of a capital campaign, and like Will, we are a 501c3, and we'll gladly accept truckloads of money. You can back it up right now to the DMN, and he and I will gladly unload it for you, bricks of gold. But yeah, so that's kind of where we're at. But I'm actually, you know, the only way you can approach it is positively. I think it's just going to get us back to our roots and get lean and mean.
Yeah.
Look out.
Yeah. And maybe to revisit the Firestorm for 1 minute, because the three of us never really talked about it. We all really liked it, I think.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Liked it quite a bit.
I did too. I loved the subtlety of it. And I'd love to talk about the ending. I won't, because I don't want to spoil it for anyone. But there were just... I love the layers to it. The fact that I won't even talk about it. There's a line in particular I would love to just discuss, and maybe afterward we will. But
okay. I just felt like it was like the perfect theatrical component to House of Cards, but it also brought up a lot of issues that I know we stuck around for a talk back that night and talked about for a while, and I know it'll leave a lot of people talking. So,
well, and that's the whole reason we chose it. It was a staged reading, actually, the year prior in 2014, and the discussion that followed it was wild, and the play was totally different, had a totally different ending at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we saw that conversation, I was like, this is the play we need to do, because this is right in the wheelhouse of the mission of Kitchen Dog, and really fit some of the people we are, you know, that we knew in the company. So we had to do it, and Meredith's a great lady, and we've had a great experience working with her. She has been involved with us since the start. So, and it's moving. You know, it's a National New Play Network rolling world premiere, as Chris said. And we'll go, you know, to Chicago at Stage Left, and then go to local theater company in Boulder, Colorado. So the play, I think, will continue to evolve based on, you know, what information she gathered here. So I think talkbacks are important.
The Firestorm runs through June 27th at McKinney Avenue Contemporary. Tickets are available online at kitchendogtheater.org. Tina, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And will you stick around to tout something?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. It's fact. Black is black is black is black. Blow! The time of the show where we give our touts. This is the portion where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. Let us start with our special guests. Will Evans, what would you like to tout?
Over the weekend, I had the distinct pleasure of going to the Dallas Contemporary. There's an exhibit up right now called Intersections by an artist whose name I will try to pronounce, Anila Kayum Aga. It won Art Prize in Grand Rapids a couple years ago, and it's on, I assume, display here, tying to Art Prize Dallas, yep, which is coming up. And it is one of the most breathtaking pieces of art I've ever experienced in person. I had seen pictures of it beforehand and didn't understand what I was looking at. And then I went and saw it in person. I still don't understand just the layers and the depth of just how beautiful this piece of art is. And, like, you know, the Contemporary is free. Like, I think everyone in the city needs to go see this thing. And, like, you know, I'm hoping that our Art Prize Dallas does something just as cool. And then, you know, eternal touts to the Wild Detectives. Going to a reading there Thursday night. It's going to be great. Kendra Green, a local author who wrote a book about the Reykjavik Phallological Museum, a whole museum on phalluses. And one cool thing about that is before I ever met her, I didn't know she lived in Dallas. Her publisher wrote me. I was like, hey, can you get a blurb from Jón Gunnar, the former mayor of Reykjavik? And I said, yeah. So he read it, and he gave a little blurb saying this is the most disturbing museum he's ever been to. It's certainly a weird place. But then I found out Kendra's local. She's just one of the local amazing literary talents we have, and she writes really cool stuff. So Thursday night at the Wild Detective, she's going to do a reading from it. And it's a beautiful little chapbook. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Tina Parker, 20 seconds ago, you had no idea what you're going to tout. Now, yeah, what would you like to tout?
Pressure.
Right. Well, this is kind of redonkulous. I went to see Mad Max. On my birthday.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I'm kind of obsessed with the weird blind heavy metal guitar person on the stage.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, my. Thank you for bringing it up.
Because I'm like, if you want to be a marauder in the future, of course you have to shred to heavy metal live. And so I've been reading a lot about how they really built the rig, like it wasn't CGI, so that makes it even more exciting. And I probably think I kind of need that guy to show up as we're moving all of our crap to all of the different locations, because everybody needs a little metal, you know, just like Sammy Hagar says, heavy metal. That song.
You should just follow all of us around and just...
Yeah, right? Yeah. Everybody needs that in your life, totally, to be like, I'm so tired. It's like... You know, like craziness.
It's like one of those little touches in that movie that just makes you say, this is batshit crazy.
Yeah. Totally. Awesome. Totally, yeah. Crazy. Awesome. And then I'll try to be sort of cool and say, I'm really into Leon Bridges right now.
Oh.
So he's local and that album is amazing. So.
Fort Worth's own.
Yeah. I do love the soul. And so I shout out to him.
Christopher Wynn.
I've got a quick twofer inspired by our guest. One is directly across from the Mac is an incredible cemetery, Greenwood Cemetery, built I think in the 1880s is when it kind of started. It's just, if you haven't been, you have to go. It is so elegant and overgrown and beautifully carved tombstone. Several former Dallas mayors are buried there.
Second oldest cemetery in Dallas, I believe.
Wow. It's stunning. And it's, even now, there's sort of, you know, the Walmart is kind of rising, you know. It's
Walmart
on the other side.
Rising.
Yeah. And there's apartment buildings all around, but it's gorgeous. So check it out. And two, go to your local library. And talking about libraries, it was a staple of my childhood, and I still nerd out and go. And I still love walking in the door. And there's that feeling of, I can have any book here I want for free right now. And just the freedom to explore. It's just, you know, support your libraries also.
I'll second that. I've spent a lot of time in libraries lately, and okay, I've been loving it. It's so quiet and peaceful.
It is.
I wish there was beer like there is at Wild Detectives, but that's okay. So mine is a play. I haven't seen it in full, but I've seen several workshop productions of a play that's coming in town from Austin this weekend. It's called Stop Hitting Yourself, and it's just like this crazy,
Stop Hitting Yourself,
zany, theatrical
Stop it, Lauren.
Ride. It's from a group called the Rude Mechanicals, and they, I swear, Tina Parker doesn't, you do different kind of theater, so you won't be offended. They're like the most interesting, devised theater troupe.
No, they're great. I know Kirk.
Yeah.
And Heather, a friend of mine, is in that show. It's an amazing show.
It's so funny. It's crazy. And it'll be one of those things that you won't know what you're getting yourself into, but you'll be glad you went. It's part of the Off-Broadway On Flora series at the Wiley Theater. I think it's only here from Thursday through Saturday. So it's going to be awesome.
I am going to tout a book. It is called Muse. It is by Jonathan Galassi, who is the head of FSG Publishing, and this is his first novel. and it is largely about the sexual hothouse that was FSG back in its glory days, with editors and publishers and secretaries. And it kind of feels a little, you can almost imagine it being like a Mad Men,
it's a very Mad Men
set,
yeah,
in the publishing world. But it also has some really funny stuff about the egos of authors and the egos of publishers. And hey, mm-hmm. Will, how you doing, man? So yeah, sorry.
Yo, books are sexy.
Yes, they are. It actually comes out June 2nd, and it's called Muse, and it's the debut novel from a guy who's been in the industry, you know, forever. But he's written poetry. He's published some collections of poetry. His first novel. It's a lot of fun. It's called Muse. You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at @mixedmediapod. Look for us soon in the iTunes store, we promise. Is that going to happen, Chris?
It's happening. It really will happen.
This isn't just some grand illusion that we're
this isn't just one big tease.
Towards. Okay. Then you'll be able to subscribe to the show. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next week with Episode 5. Until then, for Christopher Wynn and Lauren Smart, I'm Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us.